Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Deuteronomy chapter 33, verses 17 through the end of the chapter, verse 29. We are in the middle of Moses' final blessing on the sons of Israel. He's giving blessings out tribe by tribe. Our context is this. In our last audio, in verses 1 through 16 of Deuteronomy 33, Moses began the process. And I left off at verse 16 in the middle of his blessings on the tribe of Joseph, which consisted of Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, those two tribes. I probably shouldn't have broken right there. I should have gone one more verse, but that's what I did. And of course, Moses is on the plains of Moab, giving his final speeches to the Israelites before they cross over the Jordan River to conquer the land of Canaan under their general, their new leader, Joshua. So we begin now Deuteronomy 33, verse 17. He is referring to Joseph's firstborn bull has splendor and horns like those of a wild ox. He gores all the peoples with them to the ends of the earth. Such are the 10,000s of Ephraim and such are the thousands of Manasseh. Now, Joseph's firstborn bull has splendor. Interesting analogy there. Why mention that Joseph has a bull that was born first? Could it be a reference to primogeniture? A fact that the oldest son has preeminence? I think so. A firstborn son has the most power and authority in the family, and a firstborn bull would have power and authority in his bull family. And so, therefore, the analogy is just as the firstborn bull has power and authority, so does the tribe of Joseph have power and authority. Now, the NIV has a different translation. It says, in majesty, he is like a firstborn bull. Instead of saying, as the Holman Christian Study Bible says, his firstborn bull has splendor, which is just a little bit of a strained analogy here. The NIV and also the KJV says, in majesty, he is like a firstborn bull. And I think that makes sense. Joseph, i.e. Ephraim and Manasseh, have majesty like a bull that is firstborn, a bull that has preeminence in his bull family. And that bull has not only splendor, but horns like those of a wild ox. Horns are the typical symbols of strength all the way through the scriptures. Because if you think about it, if you get gored by a bull, where's the worst place to get gored? By its horns, because that's where all its physical force is concentrated, right there at the tip of that horn. Now it says, verse 17 does, that this firstborn bull gores all the peoples with them to the ends of the earth. Now, that earth can be translated as land. Benson says it should be land, the commentator Benson. Colin Delitzsch says it should be the earth. In my personal opinion, it makes more sense to say the land, because we can say that the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh will gore all the people to the ends of the land of Canaan as they conquer the land, because that's the context of what Moses is talking about here, the conquering of the land. Such are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and such are the thousands of Manasseh. Why does Ephraim have 10,000s, and where Manasseh only has 1,000? Again, these are round numbers. They're not meant to be literal. Even though Manasseh is older, he's only got 1,000. He's got less people than Ephraim. The younger guy has more, 10 times more. Well, this is according to Jacob's prediction when he blessed the patriarchs. Genesis 48:19, but his, that's Joseph's father, refused to give the blessing to the oldest, Manasseh. And he said, I know, my son, I know who's old, I know who's young, I know that Manasseh's older than Ephraim. He too will become a tribe, Manasseh, he's going to become a tribe, and he too will be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother, Ephraim, will be greater than he, and his offspring will become a populous nation. So Moses is repeating the prediction of Jacob at the end of Jacob's life. Moses repeats the same prediction at the end of his life. We go now to Deuteronomy 33, verses 18 through 19. He, that's Moses, said about Zebulun, that's one of the tribes, rejoice, Zebulun, in your journeys, and Issachar in your tents. That's another tribe, Issachar. They summon the peoples to a mountain. There they offer acceptable sacrifices. Now that they there, I think, is referring to both tribes, Zebulun and Issachar. They summon the peoples to a mountain. There they offer acceptable sacrifices, for they draw from the wealth of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. Now, this is pretty opaque. So let's start now with rejoice, Zebulun, in your journeys. The Young's literal translation has, and of Zebulun he said, rejoice, O Zebulun, in thy going out. Not journeys, but going out. John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown point out that Zebulun was a maritime tribe, and so the going out would be going out to the seas on trips into the sea. If you will look at a map of Zebulun, if you will find Mount Carmel, which is the mountain at the very tip of that promontory that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea and kind of makes a jag there, the northwest corner of Israel. And then there's a bay to the north of that jag, and you go up the coast a little bit toward Lebanon. Well, actually, it's still in Israel. And you hit Acre, and then you go up the coast a little bit further. You hit Tyre, and then you go up the coast even further, and you hit Sidon, which is in Lebanon. Tyre's right on the border of Israel and Lebanon. So Mount Carmel's a well-known place. I've been there and seen it. It's very prominent. It's sitting way up in the air. There's a nice little town on top of it now. Well, there's a river that runs from that bay, which is right to the north of Mount Carmel, at the land end, the eastern end of that bay, there's a river. It's called the Belus River. The modern name is the Naaman River. And if you run down that river just a little ways inland, you'll hit a little tribe called Zebulun. Zebulun. Now, Zebulun is said to be to draw wealth from the seas. That's because people in Zebulun, their border is on the Belus River, and they would just run down that Belus River right into the Mediterranean Sea, and they got rich off of maritime trade. Now, Zebulun is mentioned as going out, going on journeys, and Issachar is mentioned as being in the tents because Issachar was a lover of peace and pasturage. Issachar was an agricultural tribe. Agricultural tribes lived in tents. So we got a seagoing province, Zebulun, and a agricultural tribe, Issachar, and they both are summoning the peoples to a mountain. What mountain is that? That's Mount Zion. There they offer acceptable sacrifices. Acceptable means legal, not pagan. And so these two tribes are said to encourage people to worship Jehovah at Mount Zion in a proper fashion. Now, one last comment here. For those two tribes, draw from the wealth of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. Now, I think it's referring to both of the tribes, but in particular, the tribe that's being referenced here is Zebulun, because Zebulun draws from the wealth of the seas and also the hidden treasures of the sand. Now, that is a obscure reference, the hidden treasures of the sand. I'm going to give you some options as to what that could be. I'm going to give you some options that I don't think is right, and then I'm going to give you the option that I think is right. Option number one, the hidden treasures of the sand is wealth mined from the sea. Gold, silver, pearls, corals. I don't know how that is treasures of the sand. That sounds like treasures of the sea to me more than treasures of the sand. I guess you would say that the gold and the pearls and the corals are at the bottom of the sea on the sand. I don't think that's it. Here's another option. Shipwrecks. Zebulun is going to get money by exploring the wrecked hulls of ships in the Mediterranean. I don't think so. Treasures of the sand, or the ships are washed up on the beach, and so then you break into them and get wealth that way. Very clever, but I don't think that's right. Adam Clark says it's maritime commercial traffic. But again, it says treasures of the sand, so I don't see that. Adam Clark says it's treasures of the sand come from the famous shellfish called murex. Now, this makes a lot of sense. Murex made that purple dye, which is extraordinarily famous back in ancient history. You read about it all the time. And it was right off the Lebanese coast where this murex was found, and they would ship it all over the ancient Near East. And kings would use that murex to stain cloth to make it purple. And that's how kings got purple garments. And since the shellfish would be found in the sand, that would be treasure from the sand. So actually, that's a good shot at the problem there from Adam Clark. Here's what I think is the best answer. The treasure of the sand refers to glass made out of the sand. The sand is taken from the Belus River that runs along the coast of Zebulun into the Mediterranean Sea. Let me read you a quote from Adam Clark. Jonathan Ben Uziel has probably hit upon the true meaning of this difficult passage. That's a rabbi he's quoting. From the sand, says Jonathan, are produced looking glasses and glass in general. The treasures, the method of finding and working this, was revealed to these tribes. So glassmaking was the treasures of the sand. Several ancient writers inform us that there were havens in the coast of the Zebulonites in which the vitreous sand, or sand proper for making glass, was found. The words of Tacitus are remarkable. Quote, "The river Belus falls into the Jewish Sea," that's the Mediterranean Sea, "about whose mouth those sands mixed with nitre are collected, out of which glass is formed, or which is melted into glass." So the Belus River runs out into the Mediterranean, and they take the sand and they make glass. Adam, Wikipedia says this, according to the legend, this is where glassmaking was invented. So that could be Treasures of the Sand. That's a good shot. Or it could be the Murex, or it could be both. As far as Zebulon, we read the promise made to Jacob back in Genesis 49, verse 13. Zebulon will live by the seashore and will be a harbor for ships, and his territory will be next to Sidon, which is exactly what happened. And it's interesting, we'll see later, these lands were parceled out by Lot. They drew by Lot, and yet Jacob had already prophesied that Zebulun was going to end up by Sidon, which is right up the Mediterranean coast from Zebulun. We go now to Deuteronomy 33, verses 20 through 21. He, that's Moses, still speaking. Moses said about Gad, "The one who enlarges Gad's territory will be blessed. He lies down like a lion and tears off an arm or even a hand, or head, excuse me, an arm or even a head. He chose the best part for himself because a ruler's portion was assigned there for him. He came with the leaders of the people. He carried out the Lord's justice and his ordinances for Israel." Now, Gad means good fortune. We see in Genesis 30:11 when Leah had Gad, the original Gad, the eponymous leader of the tribe of Gad. Then Leah said, "What good fortune," and she named him Gad because Gad means good fortune. Now, the one who enlarges Gad's territory is God, of course. God who enlarges Gad's territory. Enlarge there means to deliver out of distress, as Clark says. The English doesn't quite say that, but according to Clark, the Hebrew means that. Deliverance out of distress, that will be God, and then God will be blessed for doing that. Now, when did God enlarge Gad's territory? Adam Clark gives three options. Option number one, when God delivered Gad, even as Jacob prophesied. Genesis 49:19, Gad will be attacked by raiders, but he will attack their heels. But now there's no particular historical event recorded there. That just means in general as they fought. Gad, of course, was in the Transjordan region, right east of the Jordan River between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, south of Bashan, north of Reuben, former Moab. And the prophecy could just refer to Gad wiping out his enemies there in the Transjordan area. That's option number one. Option number two, the enlargement that God did for Gad means the enlargement which occurred through the means of Jephthah, one of the judges. Judges 11, verse 33. He, that's Jephthah, defeated 20 of their cities with a great slaughter from Aroer all the way to the entrance of Minnith and to Abel-Karamin. So the Ammonites were subdued before the Israelites. So this is in a battle with Ammon. Remember, Ammon is the tribe that formerly owned the territory of Gad, and so there were still Ammonites around, and they had an uproar, and Jephthah wiped them out. That's option number two. Option number three could refer to victories obtained by Gad and also Reuben over the Hagrites. This is recorded in 1 Chronicles 5, 18 through 20. The sons of Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh had 44,760 warriors who could serve in the army. They waged war against the Hagrites and some other people. They received help against these enemies because they cried out to God in battle, and the Hagrites and all their allies were handed over to them. Well, it might not be clear exactly how God enlarged Gad's territory, but he obviously was fighting for him, and so he did have good fortune. His situation, his circumstances lived up to his name. Lies down like a lion and tears off an arm or a head. That's obvious. It's warlike. Verse 21, he chose the best part for himself. Now, what does that mean? Well, one option is, probably what it means is they chose the land on the east side of the Jordan rather than on the west side of the Jordan, and by doing so, they got more than if they had just gotten a portion west of the Jordan. Now, when it says he chose the best part, the NIV Study Bible says that means the best part for his livestock. It was a good place for his livestock to eat. A ruler's portion was assigned there for him. Well, what is a ruler's portion? Three options. Option number one, the portion that Moses assigned to Gad. according to Gil, because Moses was the ruler then, and so Gad got Moses' portion, the ruler's portion. Option number two, a ruler's portion is a portion that had within it the palaces and towers of great personages, as John Gill puts it, lawgivers, kings, and princes. I guess that would be pagan lawgivers, kings, and princes, the pagan ones of such who were taken over by the Israelites. Option number two. Now, option number three is, and this is my option, it just means a portion fit for a king. A king's portion, a portion fit for a king. They ended up in good shape over there on the eastern side of the Jordan River. I'm not really sure which is right. It doesn't really matter. Now, verse 21 says that he, that's Gad, came with the leaders of the people. He carried out the Lord's justice. How did Gad come with the leaders of the people and carry out the Lord's justice? Well, if you recall, the deals that Gad made with Moses is that, yeah, we'll get the eastern land, but in return for the Transjordan inheritance here, we will have to cross over with the other tribes, the other 9.5 tribes, cross the Jordan River, go into Canaan, fight the battles, help the land be conquered, and then we'll come back to our eastern portion, which they did. So when they are said to come with, that means they came with the 9.5 tribes to the west side of the Jordan River. And then carrying out the Lord's justice, it means the Gadites helped the other 9.5 western tribes fight to obtain the land. We go now to Deuteronomy verse 22 of chapter 33. He, that's Moses, continuing his speech, Moses said about Dan, Dan is a young lion leaping out of Bashan. Now, it's not Dan that's leaping out of Bashan. It's the young lion that leaps out of Bashan. And so the reference is not to where Dan is leaping, but to the fact that Dan is leaping. Well, how did he leap? Well, if you recall the story, or we'll see the story later on in Joshua, Dan didn't have enough room down there in the southwest. He was to the west of Jerusalem and a little bit south of there. He didn't have enough room, and so the Israelites gave him land in the north, and he went north and took it. And so this is the reference to Dan leaping. According to Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, they say that this metaphor, the leaping lion, probably refers to Dan extending his territories to the north because their portion originally assigned was not sufficient. We read this in Joshua chapter 19, verse 47. When the territory of the Danites slipped out of their control, that means they didn't control enough land for themselves down there in the south and southwest and the west, they went up and fought against Leshem. Now, Leshem is north of Lake Hula, which is north of the Sea of Galilee, so it's way up north at the northern end of Israel. The Danites went up and fought against Leshem, captured it, and struck it down with a sword. So they took possession of it, lived there, and renamed Leshem after their ancestor Dan. So there's Dan as a leaping lion. Now, we have a translation issue here. There's an alternate way to translate this, as the NIV Study Bible says. It says, Dan is keeping away from the viper. He's keeping away from the viper. Now, this might have a reference to Genesis 49:17. He, Dan, will be a snake by the road, a viper beside the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider falls backward. That's great. The tribe whose name I've carried for 70 years, that tribe is called a snake. A snake in the grass, a viper beside the path. Wonderful. The NIV Study Bible comments on this alternate translation and tries to see how it was fulfilled. The quotation is this, although someday he would be like a viper himself, the early history of Dan pictured him as being somewhat more timid. Well, that's kind of a mixed metaphor. He's timid, then he's like a snake. I prefer to take the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. He's a young lion, a leaping lion, extending his territory. And notice, Moses is predicting all this. This is not history. This is prophecy because it hasn't happened yet. This is what's going to happen after Moses dies and the Israelites cross the Jordan River. We go now to Deuteronomy 33, verse 23. He, that's Moses, said about Naphtali or Naphtali. I just looked it up on the internet. How do you pronounce this thing? It can go either way. Naphtali, Naphtali. He said about Naphtali, Naphtali, enjoying approval, full of the Lord's blessing, take possession to the west and the south. Now, if you look at the map, Naphtali is the province to the immediate west of Lake Hula and the Sea of Galilee. And Lake Hula is right north of the Sea of Galilee. And you go west of those two lakes, and there's Naphtali. Now, Naphtali enjoyed approval. Moses says here in verse 23, Jacob said in Genesis 49:21, Naphtali is a doe set free that bears beautiful fawns. That's pretty positive. A doe that bears fawns considered to be enjoying approval, full of the Lord's blessing. Now, what kind of blessings are we talking about here? Well, it could be spiritual, of course, but it could be natural blessings. Strabo, I'm going to give you a quote from John Gill, who quotes Strabo, the famous Greek geographer and historian. Strabo, an heathen writer, speaking of this part of the land of Judea, says it was a happy and fruitful country, bearing all manner of fruit. In this tribe was the fruitful country of Gennesaret. That means lake. That's another name for the Sea of Galilee. Full of delightful gardens and fields, which lay along by a lake of that name, Lake Gennesaret, or Gennesaret, Sea of Galilee, frequently mentioned in the New Testament. Which country, Josephus says, one may call the ambition of nature. And the Targum of Jonathan has it, quote, ye shall be full of the fruits of the valley of Gennesaret. In other words, the place was just rich, full of the Lord's blessing, as Moses says in verse 23, Deuteronomy 33. And then Naphtali is said in verse 23 to take possession to the west and the south. It doesn't say to the west and the south of what. The NIV says, translates it as, he will inherit southward to the lake. I think that makes sense. Both translations make sense. If you start at the north of Israel and go south to the west and the south, to the west and south of what? Of those two lakes, Hula and Galilee. Or the NIV is probably a little bit more accurate. He will inherit southward to the lake. You start at the north, go south all the way down to the Sea of Galilee, and a little bit beyond that too. So to the west and the south, if you say it's to the west and the south of the Sea of Galilee, which it doesn't really say, but if you assume that, then Naphtali runs south to Galilee and a little south past Galilee. Either way, we know that Naphtali is to the west and the south. We know where it is. It's on the map. We go now to Deuteronomy 33, verses 24 and 25. He, Moses still speaking, said about Asher. He turns to the next tribe, Asher. May Asher be the most blessed of the sons. May he be the most favored among his brothers and dip his foot in olive oil. May the bolts of your gate be iron and bronze, and your strength last as long as you live. Asher means happy and blessed. And so Moses is referring to the meaning of the term Asher. May Asher be the most blessed of the sons. What does it mean that Asher dip his foot in olive oil in the future? Olive oil is very expensive. And a couple of ways to look at this, or two options. John Gill says it means that Asher would have so much olive oil, which is expensive, he would have so much olive oil he could just wash his feet in it and just waste it. Or Jameson Fawcett Brown says that he will dip his foot in olive oil by using his feet in the process of extracting oil using foot presses. Dipping his feet in olive oil literally by pressing the foot presses and moving the olive oil along, squeezing the oil out of the olives. I don't know which is right. I'm 50-50 on those two options. Either one fit. Verse 25 says, may the bolts of your gate be iron and bronze. Well, of course, a gate that's iron and bronze, the symbolism is evident. Those kind of gates are very, very strong. And Moses says, may your strength last as long as you live. So Asher is to be blessed, happy and strong during his life. We go down to Deuteronomy 33, verses 26 through 28. There is none like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to your aid, the clouds in his majesty. Now, Moses has finished going through the tribes, and now he's talking to Israel as a whole. Verse 27, the God of old is your dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. He drives out the enemy before you and commands, destroy. So Israel dwells securely. Jacob lives untroubled in a land of grain and new wine. Even his skies drip with dew. Verse 26, there is none like the God of Jeshurun. Jeshurun means, quote, the upright one. That's what Jeshurun means, the upright one, and that's Israel. So there's none like the God of the upright one, Israel. This God who rides the heavens to your aid. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says that's referring to the pillar of cloud in the daytime and the pillar of fire at night that rode through the sky, helping the Israelites, and it could be. I don't know how evident that analogy is, but it could be. It could be just a general reference to the fact that God is always in his heaven running around looking to help us, running through the clouds, if you will, riding his chariot through the clouds. Verse 27, the God of old, the NIV and the KJV, has the eternal God, which I like the translation, that translation better. The eternal God is your dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Oh, that reminds us of that famous hymn, Leaning on the Everlasting Arms. I'm sure it comes right out of here in Deuteronomy 33, verse 27. He, that's Yahweh, drives out the enemy before you and commands destroy. And he's referring to the Canaanites. He's going to be driven out before the Israelites, and he's going to say destroy. You're going to be destroyed, Canaanites. And again, the purpose is to encourage the Israelites as they take on this mammoth task of conquering Canaan. Verse 28, so Israel dwells securely. The NIV says Israel dwells in safety alone. Alone would mean, I guess, with no enemies to share the land with. Or just, they're going to dwell securely. Jacob lives untroubled in a land of grain and new wine, even as skies drip with dew. And of course, we normally think of dew springing up from the ground, but where does the moisture come from for the dew to come from? It comes from the clouds in the sky. So that's okay. Not a problem there. And actually, this was Jacob's blessing. Genesis 27, verse 28, may God give to you, to Jacob, from the dew of the sky, as well as the richness of the land. Of course, you can have rich land all you want, but if you don't have water to water the crops, you need dew. And Jacob gets dew. That's part of his blessing promised in Genesis 27. And then Moses refers to it again here in his song, his speech in Deuteronomy 33. Even his skies, even Israel's skies, drip with dew. We go now to our last verse, Deuteronomy 33:29. How happy are you, Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord? He is the shield that protects you, the sword you boast in. Your enemies will cringe before you, and you will tread on their backs. Now, Moses says that Israel is happy. The NIV says blessed. Same thing. They're synonyms, really. Except when we say bless God. In that case, we mean praise God. So it doesn't work when it goes from human to God. But from God to humans, it means he makes us happy. He blesses us. He gives us good things. How happy are you, Israel? Now, it's interesting to me that Moses could end on such a positive note after he's just blasted the Israelites mercilessly in chapter 32. It says, you're going to commit idolatry. You're going to get sent off into captivity. It's a done deal. I mean, that's very discouraging. But then he finishes up on a positive note. He refers to Israel as a people saved by the Lord. I think that means that the people have been redeemed from Egypt and then preserved and saved out of the wilderness. That's how they were saved. He is the shield that protects you. Genesis 15:1 actually promised Abraham that God would be the shield of the descendants of Abraham. Genesis 15:1. After these events, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward will be very great. And of course, his reward was offspring, land, offspring, and blessings. And so the shield went for his offspring as well as for Abram himself. A shield protects, of course. So Israel has God as a shield to protect them. That's a defensive armament. And also God is the sword you boast in. So either, and that's offensive. So either defensively or offensively, God is with them. Your enemies will cringe before you, and you will tread on their backs. Now the NIV says instead of backs, it's high places, in which case the text will read, and you will tread upon their high places. The place where they committed adultery or their backs, it doesn't make any difference. It works either way, even though they mean something different. The NIV note has, they will tread upon their bodies, which is what the Holman Christian Study Bible has, is backs. So it's an alternate translation. Tread on the high places or treading on backs. Treading on the backs reminds me of Chinese masseuses who grab bars above the massage bed and then they put their dainty little feet on your spine and start jumping. And they pound you and pulverize you into your hamburger meat. But that's totally off the subject here. We're finished with Deuteronomy 33, verse 29. And that prepares us to go to the last chapter in Deuteronomy. It's only 12 verses, Deuteronomy 34. And we will read about the death of Moses. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.